Chapter 20 of When Thief Meets Thief by Harry Stephen Keeler. The Threads of the Past. From the night when I had said goodbye to my princess, under the stars, up to that day when I walked into Kamehameha Park, romance and love had played no part in my life. The nearest I came to it was when Carmen de Alvarado had offered me herself in a presidency, though I had met with many other chances for forgetfulness of that youthful love. But I could not forget, as I have said once before, I am one of the few men who were made that way. At times I had been prosperous in my career as a cracksman, and had every chance with women of every sort, though I found, as is commonly stated, that sort of money never stays, and my periods of prosperity had often been followed by near starvation. And, because I was what I was, one who lived in fear of discovery by the police time and again, though I was never even suspected, for a time I gave up the idea of ever going back to see if the princess had remembered. Then, with this chance of beating Stevens and making an honest competency by exposing him, the thought had come to me again that, with at least $50,000 of clean money in my hands, I might go back to find her and win her for my own. And there, sitting on a bench that I was about to pass in Kamehameha Park, was the girl of my dreams, just as beautiful as when I had known her in the long ago, just as much to me, at sight of her I knew, even more to me than she had been in our early youth. I stood looking down at her, amazed and incredulous, and she gazed up at me. "Jerry," she said at last, "imagine meeting you here." "And you too, princess," I said, and dropped down on the seat beside her, putting down my baggage on the other side. "Hawaii," I added, "surely is the fairy land the travel agencies say it is, since one finds dreams come true in it. But what are you doing here?" For I'd caught sight of the ring on her left hand that told me I had found her again too late, and with that the sunshine paled for me, and I knew how deeply set the dream of ending her free and winning her for my own had been. The sight of that ring changed life for me, and I could see by her eyes as she gazed at me that she knew I had seen it. Something in her look, too, the gladness at meeting me, I think it was, said that she had remembered in spite of the ring and what it meant. For a long while, it seemed a long while to me, she sat silent. "I'd better tell you all of it, Jerry," she said at last. "There's no need, my dear," I told her rather bitterly. "The fact is plain enough. Why state the details of how it happened?" "Oh, Jerry, you used not to be so bitter," she pleaded. "Listen, you married before I did. I have had waited all my life if—" "Stop there," I interrupted her. "Married before you did? What fool's tale is this, when I've never married at all? Never thought of or looked at another woman to love her since you and I said goodbye." "Jerry," she exclaimed, "is that true? Didn't you—" "But I saw the newspaper clipping, and it was you. They gave particulars." "Now wait," I interrupted her again, no longer willing that she should hold back any of the details of this mix-up. "Just begin at the beginning, the night I said goodbye to you, if you remember it."
"Remember it?" she interrupted in turn. "I've never forgotten. I've never—" "But I'll tell you all of it, since you ask." And pausing only to collect the facts in her mind, she told me all that had happened after my college career was broken and I had to go away from her, and all the other prospects I had seen till that day. Of her father's death, her mother's increasing illness, and of how Wally had come to her and shown her the newspaper account of my marriage. "Have you got that account anywhere?" I stopped to ask her then. "Why, yes." She opened her bag and took out an elastic-banded package of old letters and the like. "I brought these with me because I didn't feel it would be safe to leave them, only old things that one treasures because of the times they represent." She chose out a badly worn slip cracking at its folds, and handed it to me. And first I read it, saw my own fictitious wedding, and then saw how it had been done. Never printed on a machine at all, but hand-pulled, in a proof press, and then trimmed off to look like a real news item. With the name of the supposed newspaper, a San Francisco sheet, and the supposed date of the event written in at the top. Didn't it strike you, I asked, that if this had been a real cutting from a paper, it was a bit odd that my incomplete college course should have been mentioned in it? That's hardly the sort of thing the bride's people would be likely to advertise, is it? I never thought of that, she confessed after a pause. It hurt me so much, Jerry. So soon after you had promised, and I'd promised too. No, I never thought to question it. Wally's own work, beyond doubt, I said. Look here, far too much width of this side for another column to run down beside it in any newspaper. Too much space left at the top and the bottom for it to fit into any news column, and, I turned it over, if newspapers were printed like this, they'd never be whole sheets. See the way the letters are pressed through the paper, and most telling of all, you see there is no print of any kind on the back of the cutting. No newspaper runs sheets blank on one side, don't you see? She looked at the paper and then again at me, with trouble in her eyes. But go on, I bade her. I suppose Wally did this in order to get you for himself, and in the end, he did get you, eh? She went on with her story, told me how Wally had been all chivalry and considerateness, both to her and her invalid mother, how in the end she had consented to marry him, believing that I had married and forgotten her, and how, on their wedding day, Wally had been turned from a healthy, athletic youngster to a helpless cripple, condemned to lie on his back for the rest of his life. And since that day she had been no more than nurse to an invalid, whose brain was the only part of his anatomy that could function actively as before the accident. Then, in the full sense, you're not his wife, I asked her. Nor ever have been, she told me, just as you left me, Jerry. And so it must be to the end, his end, which may come any day, and again may not come till I'm quite old. But there's hope, at least, I reflected. She put her hand on mine. No, Jerry, it would be wrong to hope. It would be hoping for his death, and that's utterly wrong. But it's a mere mockery of life for you, tied to a man like that, I urged. You can't waste all your life like that. And if he knew you still cared for me, do you still care for me, princess? Her eyes answered me before she said, you know, without asking. Then if he knew, if you went to him and told him. You don't know him, she broke in, or you would not say that. He has told me not for anything on earth would he divorce me, and you must see it's impossible for me to divorce him. No court would grant it, especially since I've been apparently content with my life for so long. I have no cause, no outward cause, that is. How do you mean, no outward cause, I asked. Only that when I'm alone with him, he sometimes reminds me of all he's done for me, how he made the end of my mother's life easy for and gives me all I want, as long as I do all he asks. And what does he ask? I questioned, inwardly damning a man who could remind her of her obligations while he held her tied from any real happiness, as obviously he did by her story. Just that, you see, when his father died, he inherited all the business, and it's a big and flourishing one, too, she explained. I practically run it for him, under his instructions, of course. That's why I'm here, Jerry, except that I stayed a few days longer than I needed as a rest from the perpetual peevishness I had to endure while I'm with him. You can never know what my life has been. I picked up my belongings, and she gave me a fearful look. Oh, Jerry, you're not running away from me, are you? She begged. You're not angry with me for all I've told you, sorely. Not at all, princess, I said, and saw the color come back into her dear, lovely face as she heard me. No, but we're in everybody's view here on this seat, and someone might come along and recognize you talking to me, or even recognize me talking to you. Let's go and find some place a little more out of the world's eye.
We move to one of the little semi-enclosed bowers that dot Kamehameha Park, a little nook covered with vines and a single rustic bench inside which gave room for the two of us, plenty of room from my point of view, since she was the one with me. And here we talked and talked until it was time to go to her hotel. Of myself now, since she had told me all her story. I had to make mine as I told it, for not for the world would I have let her know all that my life had been since my incomplete training in dentistry had broken off and I had had to say goodbye to her after the party and the mock marriage between us that Phil Dotworth had conducted. I told her all the tale of my South American adventures, except, of course, that I missed out my training in safe-cracking by Cape Town Slim. There was no word of safes in all the story, in fact. Her eyes sparkled as I told of the capture of Gonzales and Carmen's offer of her father's palace and herself. I saw them grow soft and happy when I told her the thought of her had kept me from accepting the offer while her hand stole out of mine and to find mine and stayed there. She had no more forgotten or ceased to care than I had, I knew now. I went on to tell her of my trapping days, spinning the story out to keep her with me. All that could be revealed of my life to anyone she learned that day, and to account for my presence there with her, I explained myself as a salesman traveling for firms dealing in structural steel. In that capacity, I had come over to Honolulu with no more baggage than she saw me there beside, to close a deal. But I was careful to add I had been dissatisfied with my employment and had wired my resignation, while I intended to go back to the States by the next Matson liner to leave on the following day and see about a new and better post that had been offered to me before I left. In the fiction of my life, as it was here and now, I was as fertile of invention as my grandfather had been when he wrote those stories that brought wealth to Tillery Stevens, and not one word of Tillery was there in my tale. "Then you're not compelled to go tomorrow," she asked, after I had ended my story and she had thought it over for a brief while. "No," I answered, "it isn't really compulsory, though. But why do you ask, Princess? What could I gain by staying?" It's selfish of me," she said, hesitatingly, "but I wasn't thinking of what you would gain. I was thinking of myself, Jerry, how you kept your loyalty to our promise and how terribly I wish I'd kept mine. Now I see you again. And a day or two out of all the years?" "You mean?" I asked, with my arm round her now, for the arbor sheltered us and there was nobody to see. "To meet and talk. To see you, Jerry," she said. I took her quite close to me, and she did not resist. Some part of the dream of years had come true for us, though we knew we could not realize it, and there in the little vine-colored solitude she clung to me as I held her, and so wakened all the longing there was in both of us. Then, breathless, she disengaged herself from my hold. "I must go, Jerry, dear," she said. "There are still things to be done. The things I came here to do. But just a day or two?" "Tomorrow, in any case," I said. There were plenty of boats, I knew, and one more day with her. She did not want it more than I did. I went out from the park with her and later found me a cheap room for the night. There, sleeping little, I questioned why I had acceded to her request. To meet again like that would only add to the emptiness of the future after we parted, and yet she was, still is, so dear that refusal was impossible, though I knew it would have been better for us both if I had refused. Love is like that, unreasoning, unescapable, and I had the repression and waiting of years behind me. We met quite early that next day and talked again of what is it that lovers talk when they are as near to each other in thought and wish as were we two? Some part of the time we managed to forget everything but our two selves, and she was her old, laughing, happy self, the girl of my dreams, back here with me. Again, we would remember that all this was just one little moment of happiness and an otherwise empty eternity of separateness from each other. "Oh, my dear, the terrible mistake I've made," she said, "that I didn't marry you or at least engage myself to you in the time when we knew each other and wait for you." "Not that, darling," I told her. "It's not your mistake that condemns us to say goodbye again and go our ways, but Wally's deceit in telling you I was married. We can blame him for it all." And then I lost all restraint, took her in my arms, and begged her to forget him and risk life with me. But she would not. "No," she said, "I can't, Jerry. It would be a spoilt happiness, though, as you say, he is to blame. But his helplessness, his dependence on me for everything, even to managing his business for him as I do, don't you see I must go on? Oh, it isn't that I must be true to him, but to myself. It's my path, and I must follow it." She was right, of course, and only a moment of returning sanity was enough to show me the course that I had proposed was impossible. Until I should have beaten Tillery Stevens and forced what I wanted from him, there could be no real future for us, even if she had acceded to my plea. My hand-to-mouth life, with its crib-cracking necessities, was not one that I had any right to ask her to share. "But we have these hours," she said, "have them for always. Nothing can ever spoil the memory of them for me, my dear." "Few, all too few," I said. "Just a day, perhaps tomorrow, and then to have nothing but the memory. Princess, life owes us more than that. Wally has cheated us. Is all life to cheat us of each other?" She gave me the quaint, adorable smile that she knew how to summon up, and shelved the question in her own way. "Jerry, I'd give half a world to say it shouldn't. You know I would. But just for now, we've been here hours and I'm getting terribly hungry. I know it's practical and not a bit romantic, but aren't you just a little bit hungry too? Do say you are." I had not thought of it, but I found that I was. We went out from the park and found a little restaurant where we had a really sumptuous lunch, though I forgot it all. I forget all of it now and know only that she faced me while I ate. Then we went back to the park, found our arbor empty as we had left it, since it was in one of the least frequented parts, and all the while a resolve was growing in my mind. I felt that, since we had actually met again, fate and Wally between them should not cheat us of each other altogether. There was, I felt sure, a way out of that. "Princess," I asked her, "when do you go back to the States?" "When I like," she answered. "That was why I dared to suggest your missing the boat today and giving the time to me. I can go tomorrow if you're not here, next week, any time, as long as I go back. If I get back to Wally in a month from now, it will be time enough. But I must go in the end. Understand that, Jerry. It's no use your trying to persuade me. I must go back to him in the end because he is what he is, a helpless cripple dependent on me, and knowing I won't fail him." "You won't, for all that he can ask of you," I said. "But, Princess, we've got one chance, and one only, probably for as long as we both shall live, to have just an interlude of that paradise fate, and Wally have tried to rob for us entirely. Just one chance." "What do you mean, Jerry?" she asked. "Well," I said slowly, "I've got to go back to the States, and so have you. I'm going almost at once, and therefore so are you." She did not answer. She looked at me, and I knew that she understood. Knew, too, that she hadn't it in her heart to refuse. "In such a case as ours," I urged, "do conventions count for so much? It's robbing nobody, harming nobody. Princess, this is our chance, just for the little time that remains before we say goodbye again. Not here in Hawaii, but when we land at the end of our journey to the States. No, don't say it's impossible, because it isn't. You mean you'll... She hesitated quite a long time. You'll go back? Back to San Francisco with me as... She could not end it except with her eyes, which looked her understanding at me. I mean just that. For us two to go together and grasp the little bit of happiness life offers, I said. For my dear, it won't be offered us again like this, I feel sure. We may never meet again, but we shall have had that unforgettable bit of our life, if you will. Yes, I will go like that, Jerry, she promised gravely. Like you, I feel it's due to us, and I'm going back to what I think is the place I ought to keep afterward, just the same. But, my dear, how can it be done? I don't know. Perhaps it makes no difference as far as you are concerned, but if anyone who knew me were to know, recognize me while I'm traveling with you like that, don't you see, it would give him... Wally, such a hold over me that my life would be impossible from the day that he learned. I daren't risk that. Darling, I wasn't suggesting going back with you on a liner. That would be impossible, I know, for someone in the passenger list or somebody among the crew might recognize you. In fact, fate arranges these things so that one is recognized invariably. I think it was Mark Twain who said that if Jonah... had arranged to meet his best girl inside the whale, he'd have found a score of his friends leaning against the ribs of the thing, with bull's-eye lanterns to watch the show. No, not a liner, Princess. I'm thinking for you over that part of it, for I wouldn't care who knew what I did. Which was not strictly true, since a good many of my enterprises would not stand daylight. Still, it was true as far as this particular project was concerned. Then what will you do, Jerry? She asked. I'm going to nose around after I leave you today, I said, and find some obscure little freighter, such as are always coming to Honolulu. One, for preference, that could turn its captain's cabin into an accommodation for two at need, while the captain turns in somewhere else because he's pocketing the passage money and not booking his passengers or disclosing that he's got any aboard. It can be done, I know. She sat silent a long while, weighing it from all sides, I knew, and just a little fearful. I would not have had her otherwise over it. Then she nestled close to me and smiled as she looked up. My chance, my little chance for happiness, she said wistfully. A little interval while I belong where I want to be, and then I shall be strong enough to go back. But that first... Yes. It was mid-afternoon when at last we parted, she to go and attend to the fine details of the business that had brought her to Hawaii, and to pack in readiness for departure, and I to arrange the passage, or rather, to find the sort of freighter on which it would be possible to arrange such a passage as I wanted for the two of us. I know I was like a schoolboy let loose, and felt that the very top of the world was just in front of me that day. A week of paradise, at least, was before me, sea and sky and sun and my princess mine, at last. The impermanence of it, the fact that it could not last much longer than a week, and that the desolation of losing her for good was at the end of it, did not spoil my happiness then. I put it aside, out of my thoughts, and saw only the immediate future, the days with her. But there was something to which I had to attend before beginning to look for the boat that should take us back together. I went into the lobby of our obscure hotel. After seeing through the open doorway that there was such a thing as a writing desk inside, and on Birch Cadwallader stationery, though I had used only one or two of the sheets I had taken from the studio bungalow, in only one of the two government-stamped 2-cent envelopes, I inscribed an epistle to Tellery Stevens, after a good deal of thought, as to the best story to hand to him. And this is how the letter panned out. Dear Tellery, I made the place okay last night, as you can see from this piece of stationery I picked up in it. But Tillery, there was nary sign of a skull anywhere about the shebang. He undoubtedly loaned it to some other artist, and the latter is holding on to it as a useful property and keeping his mouth tight shut now that Cadwallader is dead. I'm damned sorry. I'll tell the world, for I sure do need your $250 bonus badly. In fact, far more than you really need this skull, since it's only because you want to push past a hoodoo that you wanted it all. Returning in a couple of days via Matson line. We'll luck you up if my wake takes me through Chicago, as it will sooner or later. Jerry. After I had sealed and posted that communication, I went out again and, for a start, bought me a cheap but new outfit of clothes, throwing away most of those I'd had on, since the trip sub Rosa with my Australian pal on the Malola had got them to the state when a garbage heap would think twice before giving them a really hearty reception. In fact, when I came to give what I had taken off the once-over, I wondered how it happened that my princess had let herself recognize me in such an outfit. Except that I knew she had looked at the man, and not at what he was wearing. Then I went off in my new rig out, found exactly the boat I wanted to find, and managed to arrange the passage for the two of us. In other words, I squared the captain of that boat, and there were no questions about names or why two of us wanted to travel like that when liners galore were at hand, or in fact, any questions at all. Money talked, as it always does, and the captain went dumb. By 6 o'clock that evening, I was back in Kamehameha Park, where I had arranged to meet my princess and tell her what news I might have. She listened grave-eyed while I explained what I had done, and then gave a happy little laugh as she realized all that was before us. "And you'll call for me at my hotel?" she asked, which proved how childishly ignorant she was of all that might be involved in such an adventure as this, which now lay before us too. "I will not, darling," I told her. "Just suppose an old friend of your school days, or any other sort of friend or acquaintance who knew you, blew into the far distance as we went away together, and then looked in at the hotel to find out when you would be back and discovered that you were not coming back at all. And then that same old school friend, or any other sort of friend, went off and burbled to Wally that you'd obviously left Honolulu the best part of a fortnight before you landed in Frisco, and had last been seen with a strange man at that. How does a situation of that sort strike you?" "Of course, it was silly of me to think of such a thing," she answered with a thoughtful frown. "Then what do I do? You do not want me to make this trip with... You do want me to make this trip with you, don't you?" I held her close to answer. That ignorance of the world's ways, that naivete I found in her just as much now as in the far back days when we had been boy and girl together, made her very dear to me. "Darling, I tell you it's all planned. Passages booked. No, arranged, though not booked, for the two of us, and not a chance of a soul ever getting to know how we went back from here, or that we ever did get back, let alone made the trip together. No, all I want you to do is to get a porter or someone of the sort to torch your baggage and meet me just 100 yards on the far side of the customs house from your hotel. I'll be waiting there till you turn up. And see to all the rest, darling. You'll have nothing more to worry about." Except she gave me a pout and then a smile with the reminder, "You haven't told me what time the porter and I are to be there." "Oh, that's all set," I said and laughed. "Just have your dinner at the hotel, and you'll find me waiting at 8:30, waiting very anxiously, too, in case something should happen at the last minute to spoil things for us. Not that I think that anything can." For a few minutes more, we talked together, things that concerned only our two selves and had no place here. I remember her as a bit grave just then, as if the magnitude of all that we contemplated, all that it might mean if some chance should bring it to the knowledge of others, were in her thoughts, behind the things she said. And at the last she put her arm around my shoulders as we sat and looked straight into my eyes, a look that lives in my memory. "My dear," she said,
I'm trusting myself to you for this time before us, because I feel that somehow life has cheated us too. Cheated us of each other in the way we wanted. So we're going to cheat it in our turn. Make this little interlude out of life to last us all the rest of life and all of time as we shall know it. Quite out of life. Something apart to keep as our secret because I love you so, my dear. Words could not answer that, nor did they. But I know my reply contented her. Then we went back, out from the little arbor. I have never seen it since, she to go to her hotel and I to wait for the next time of meeting in a sort of desperate anxiety that I had never known in life before. Supposing at this very last something should go wrong, rob us of all that we had planned. 8 o'clock, let alone 8:30, found me waiting at the appointed place. The custom house cut off the view of my princess's hotel, and I did not want to make myself conspicuous by getting to a point of vantage to wait for the sight of her. Instead, I lurked in the shadows. It was not yet moonrise, and thus, at the very last minute, the thing I feared nearly happened. Yet not the thing I feared, for my fears had had no shape, and what did happen was totally unexpected. All my thoughts were concentrated on my princess and her coming to me, not on things near at hand. Someone came at me from behind, out of the deeper shadows, and was on me before I had any warning of an impending attack. I sensed a big black man as I went down under his weight, and managed to turn over to grapple with him, half dazed though I was with the suddenness of it. I smelt him, an evil smell, as he tried to get a grip on my throat. I thought to go for his eyes, at which he got me by the wrists. We rolled over and over in the dust there. I think at first sight of me he judged that the difference between his weight and mine would give him an easy victory, but he did not know what I had at stake, or what it would mean if he outed me and my princess did not find me waiting. I fought him as I have never fought before or since, with teeth and feet and knees as well as fists and arms, yet it was a very near thing, for surprise had given him the advantage over me at the outset. 5 minutes or less of breathless, silent, desperate struggle, and then he got a grip on my throat and grunted a vicious satisfaction. At that I relaxed, foxing, for I knew that if he kept his hold only for 30 seconds, my princess would never find me, and he half lifted himself, still keeping the stranglehold, to kneel beside me. Then came my chance. My knee took him in the stomach, and he loosed his hold and rolled a yard away from me, winded and beaten. I was on him at once, pounding him in the stomach. His muscles there must have been underdeveloped, though he had mighty shoulders and arms. Less than 10 minutes from his attack on me, I stood over him as he lay prostrate and waited for him to get breath enough to speak. "Now, you hound, what was the idea?" I demanded. "Boss," he wheezed out weakly, "I's starvin' in the midst of plenty, and I guessed happened it'd get a dollar." "Why the hell couldn't you ask me for a dollar?" I queried, half inclined to laugh at such a fool, now that he was no longer dangerous. "I asked and asked, boss, and nobody give me a cent. And I's des famished, boss, des prit. I don't mean no harm, I don't." "No, it felt as if you didn't when you jumped on me. I fished up a dollar in spite of being attacked like that. Here," I dropped it on his chest. "Go off and get a feed, where and how you like, and count yourself lucky I don't land you on a course of free board and lodging at government expense. Get up and get the hell out of here." "Boss," he sat up and grabbed the dollar, "yo sure is the whitest white man I ever tried to slug, and I sure prays for you at meeting next Sunday if it's that last act. Yes, I gonna go pray for you out of date. Too, and I hopes you'll meet you at a time when I got a dollar to give back to you, 'cause I's honest, I is." "Then I'll hope the next nigger I meet isn't," I told him. "If this is the way honest ones act in these islands, Now hoof it, quick. I watched him scramble to his feet, watched carefully, lest his honesty should prompt him to have another go at me in the hope of a second dollar. But he merely said, "The good Lord bless you, boss," and he shambled off, still bent a little as effect of the terrific pounding in the stomach I had given him. When he was clear away, I looked at the custom house clock, visible from where I stood, and saw with my heart in my boots that it already marked a quarter of 9 o'clock. Something had gone wrong at my princess's inn then. I dusted off my clothes with my hands as best I could after that scuffle with the big black, and prepared to go along to the hotel, for time was getting short. Fortunately, my suit was not torn, only soiled by the dry, sandy dust which would easily brush out. I started for the hotel, only to see the princess coming into sight from beyond the custom house, and following her the porter carrying her baggage. "I couldn't get a man to carry the things for ever so long," she greeted me. "I was beginning to be afraid I should have to come along with nothing at all, or else miss the boat, and you—" "As long as you're here, nothing else matters," I answered. But what has happened to you?" she asked, noting my disheveled state and a scratch down my cheek of which I was unaware myself. "It'll keep till we get aboard," I said. "Something which, well, a dollar's worth of trouble, call it. Let's go, and I'll tell you later. If that boat should sail without us—" She asked no more, but followed me along the quayside until I went aboard, and following her, the porter dumped her belongings just beyond the ship end of the gangplank and went his way. And there we were, embarked at last on the great adventure we had planned. And just as the big Hawaiian moon rose above the peaceful waters of the Pacific, two persons, a princess and a cracksman, sailed for the States together, the only two white people aboard the Chinese freighter, Ning Wah.